Hello and welcome to Weird. I'm Katie, a science writer.
And I'm Amy, a nurse.
We're cousins and we have an unhealthy obsession with the bizarre side of science.
This is Weird, the podcast.
We're glad you're listening in today. This is Weird, the podcast, where we take a nosedive into the wacky parts of the world.
We each have an odd science topic that we've researched, and we'll start by flipping a coin to see who presents first. And the coin, again, is on my phone because who carries real money?
That's the world we live in.
Yeah, who carries real money anymore? Okay, am I heads again? Should I be heads? I'll be heads.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's tails. So you go first.
Ooh, okay, cool. My topic is a couple topics, and they are evolutionary structures that animals have developed to aid in their entry to the world. So either entry out of an egg, or I guess exit out of an egg, or things that animals have that go away after they're born. So to start off, you know very well what this is, an egg tooth. So what is an egg tooth? For the viewers, Amy has had and bred and raised several a bird. So she has definitely seen an egg tooth.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely not on purpose. Like I had these parakeets and there was a girl parakeet and a boy parakeet and they did a thing. And then yes.
Maybe that's a lesson for another episode.
Yes.
How baby birds are made.
Yeah, I know. Right. I'm like, that should have been common sense on my part that was going to happen.
But also it led to your adorable, lovely little birds that were
And then we got like this really cute family. And I like learned so much about breeding birds and
totally.
And anyways, yeah. I had a parakeet that hatched and I was at home and I could hear it happening. So like went over to the little nest box and they like watched her break the shell all the way around with this little, it's like a little horn that is on like the end of their beak, and they like literally just like use their little beak and like keep rotating, like doing this backflip like within their egg, and they just like poke little holes all the way around their shell.
That's so cute. And yeah, and that's sort of the extent that I knew about it before I started doing more research. Well, and I know that, you know, it's other species too, and actually some ones that I did not expect there. I knew about birds. I knew that many reptiles have them as well, like snakes do. And so I almost had, maybe I'll get her for the, when I keep talking about snake egg teeth here, if it's snake and several reptiles in my house. Okay, so maybe a little bit of background for people who have not seen an egg tooth in person. It is a tiny, temporary, little tooth-like structure that grows on the tip of the beak, snout, mouth of the animal that hatches from an egg to help it escape the egg. And they only need it for the actual act of hatching. So that's why it's temporary. It falls off after they don't need it anymore. Sometimes it falls off. Sometimes it is reabsorbed. It depends on the species. It depends on the type of animal. Did you notice with your birds that did it fall off?
I think it reabsorbed. I don't remember seeing it fall
just
off.
Just like one day it was not there.
It was just, yeah, it was like, and like they grow so fast, you know? Right. So it's like, I mean, yeah. Like
the size of the beak is evolving anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah that makes sense.
I think it reabsorbed, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. From what I found, I think a lot of birds, typically it is reabsorbed in the bird, but it falls off in some other species. But yeah, so you know, birds, reptiles, so snakes, crocodiles, turtles have it. And with birds, this part, I don't know if you know this part or not, but maybe it's not just birds, maybe it's several species. As probably a lot of people know, there's a little pocket of air in an egg. And so, you know, when you make a hard-boiled egg and you peel it, and usually there's that little concave area in the egg, that's because there is a little pocket of air for the animal to breathe. And so they use it two times, their egg tooth. They use it when they're ready, when they know they're ready to come out. They find their little pocket of air and they slice the pocket of air and they start breathing that air to get strong enough to then do the rest of their hatching journey. So they'll do that maybe after a few hours of breathing, of using their lungs and experiencing what it's like to actually breathe for real. Then they're like, okay, I'm ready. Then they rotate and then they start breaking the side of the egg. So they cut it on the tip of the egg where the air sac is, and then they rotate and then they start breaking. So they use it two different times to escape their egg.
I don't think I knew that they used it to break the air sac. like to like access the air sac. I don't think I knew that actually.
Yeah, I don't think I did either. I knew that the air sac existed, you know, and I think just intuitively, a lot of people realize there's an egg sac just again from like boiling eggs and noticing that little kind of hollowed out area. And I knew that that was to give the bird air, but it's also to give them enough room to then have, because they have to sort of, you know, wind their little head back in like ice pick style, tap, tap, tap. And before they burst that sack of air, they don't have enough room in the egg to actually do the motion to have their head go back and forth and actually do that ice pick motion to get out of the egg. So that pocket of air is just super critical for them to be hatching.
Interesting. Yeah, I knew about the pocket of air, and I knew that like they use that to breathe when like when they were doing their little rotation to crack the shell, mostly because I know that if it takes them too long to like do the crack, they can run out of air and suffocate inside their shell.
Yes. Yes. Horrible. For sure. And that happens a lot. And actually, as another note I had, that a lot of breeders of birds, reptiles, Well, I guess I don't know too much about birds, but I watch a lot of snake breeder videos and they often will cut a little slit in the egg once the first of like the batch of eggs starts pipping. They will usually cut the other ones a little tiny slit just to give them a head start. Because in kind of captivity, that evolutionary feature, sometimes, you know, sometimes you get a snake or a bird or whatever without an egg tooth, but they're otherwise healthy. And, you know, that wouldn't be a good reason to just let them die if it's just going to be a pet. Obviously, they would die in the wild if that happened, and that does happen. So it's less common for them to be missing an egg tooth in the wild, much more common in bred pets. So now for some other interesting, weird facts about egg teeth. So usually they just have one, you know, right at the tip of their top beak, or on a snake or turtle, the tip of their, you know, top upper jaw. But there are certain species that have two egg teeth, and that is the woodpecker. The woodpecker has two egg teeth, one on the top and one on the bottom. And I couldn't really find exactly why. I don't know if it's because their egg is stronger or, I mean, when you think about it, a woodpecker really needs to have a strong sense of like pecking things.
Yes. So
I don't know if it has something to do with just the way that a woodpecker behaves. But yeah, they have two. And the kiwi, the fat little cute, you know, is it Australia or New Zealand or both bird? I think Australia, right? Or maybe it's in both. But
either or both.
Cute little flightless bird, the kiwi, they do not have an egg tooth. They're one of the few birds that has no trace of an egg tooth whatsoever, because they're so strong. They just
like Hulk themselves out of their eggs.
They just become the Hulk and they just burst through just with sheer force.
That's crazy.
So yeah, they're one of the stronger hatchers out there. And yeah, those are the sort of anomalies, I guess, with bird egg teeth. And like I mentioned before, for birds, usually it will fall off or get reabsorbed. It's more of like a keratin, you know, material, same material as the beak itself. It's just like a extension of the beak. But for snakes and lizards, it's an actual tooth, but just meant to fall out. So it actually, instead of just being, let's say, you know, if your fingernail, you know, is made from the same material as a beak, you know, let's say you just had a little growth on your fingernail, like that would be the same as a bird. But like, yeah, it's an actual separate tooth structure for snakes and lizards. So they actually lose it and it falls off as a distinct little piece.
So like on a snake or a lizard, like, is it on their face? Like,
yeah, it's just right in the center of their lip, and like where our Cupid's bow would be. It's like right there at the end. I mean, essentially the same place that it is on a bird, like right on their kind of upper part of their mouth. So, you know, the place that they can peck the most. And actually, and the reason for that is because of the way they hatch, right? So bird eggs, as I think most people are aware, are hard and crunchy on the outside. So you really need that like ice picking tap, tap, tap motion. But reptile eggs are this leathery type of texture. So, you know, you wouldn't get very far with just poking and hitting it. So they slice it. So that's why they need a tooth type of structure rather than, you know, just a little hard piece, because they are actually cutting it. They have a little pocket knife.
they cut their way out. Oh, that's so
when you see reptile eggs that are, you know, pipping. I think pipping is still the correct term for reptiles. It literally looks like someone had a little knife in there and was just like, tee, 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 you know, and they'll like slice.
Oh, that's so funny.
They're like little fencers and they just slice their way out. Oh, and then with crocodiles, it's made of skin. So it's the same material as like the skin on their body. Sometimes it's made out of the same material as like a fingernail or a beak. Sometimes it's an actual tooth like in a snake or lizard. And sometimes it's an extension of their skin on their upper lip. So different animals have evolved to have different types of egg teeth for their specific needs. So it's not just snakes and lizards and turtles and birds, but platypuses, platypuses. Fun fact, octopi is incorrect. It's octopodes.
Mm-hmm.
We learned that from one of my good friends who was a classics major, mm-hmm. and I remember it all the time. I tell everyone I know that uses octopi. Yep. No, it's octopodes.
Yep. It's octopodes.
but yeah, platypus and platypodes and echidnas, which are monotremes, which is an order of mammal. They have it too. So mammals can have them. Birds can have them. Reptiles can have them. Amphibians, so frogs, can have them. And this was my favorite fact of all. I even texted you about this earlier. Spiders have little tiny baby spider egg teeth. Mainly tarantulas. I'm sure other types of spiders do too, but I could find very little on them. But yeah, tarantulas have a little tiny tarantula egg tooth to get out of their little egg. And I'm sure, and again, I couldn't find much information on them. The spider egg tooth, but it's a different type of egg. You know, a mm-hmm. spider egg is like a silky material.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different than a reptile egg that's very leathery. It's very different than a chicken egg, which is very tough and you know, fracturable.
And is it, I wonder if I'm sure, because a tarantula's mouth is like underneath it.
Yes.
You know? So, mm-hmm. like,
yes. Okay. So, for the viewers, and this is going to be a later episode, Amy and I are very into tarantulas. We went on a whole trip to see the tarantula migration, where they meet, males migrate to find mm-hmm. a mate down in southern Colorado. We're from Colorado. So, we did a lot of research on tarantulas. I wrote a story about tarantulas. So, we are a little bit versed in the anatomy of a tarantula. Can you guess what it's the same spider organ that does another important...
Is it the hook?
Not the hook. Good guess. Yeah, so the hooks, they have hooks on their feet to hook into the female, the males do, so yeah. that they can
impregnate her. Oh, I guess females wouldn't have the hooks, so...
Yeah.
I don't know.
So it's on the pedipalps, which are their little, like, extra little helping hands by their mouth, which is also basically their mating organ.
Hmm.
So, like, it's very important for tarantulas.
Yeah.
So they have this egg tooth on the end of their... So I guess they must have two, because the spider has two little...
Yeah, they have two pedipalps they use to, like, poke
to eat, to give their sperm packet to the female tarantula. Yes. And apparently that is also what houses the egg tooth. So...
Oh, wow. So they actually, like, use, like, their little arm, and they, like... Boop, 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 like poke their way out of their shell.
Yeah. And I wish I had more information. I couldn't find as much on the tarantula egg teeth as the other species. But yeah, that's what I find so fascinating about the whole idea of egg teeth. You know, it had to evolve in so many different ways. You know, there's certain evolutionary things across the animal kingdom that evolved, you know, separately in separate parts of the planet, and yet somehow evolution's found a way to make it over on this side of the planet and over here, even though those animals are not actually directly related. Mm-hmm. And this is a perfect example of that, where it's not just, oh, this type of bird has this type of egg tooth and that type of bird. Nope, it is in birds, reptiles, arachnids, mammals, like,
yeah,
all the different types of the animal kingdom can have an egg tooth.
If you're in an egg, you need a way to get out.
Yeah. So,
unless
you're
a kiwi.
Unless you're a kiwi and you just hulk out of your egg.
Bust out of there.
You just bust right out of there. Yeah, I just found that so interesting. And it's amazing that, yeah, this little tiny structure is so important. And arguably it's like the most important structure to that animal, because if they didn't have it, they'd never be born. They'd just perish in the egg, you know, and the egg is such an interesting evolutionary wonder, but the egg tooth had to evolve hand in hand with the egg. Otherwise, you know, how would it get out? And so I mentioned, you know, I have two different structures I'm going to be talking about that are like, I guess, opposites, but they both have to do with entering the world. So, you know, the egg tooth helps the creature escape from the egg. But there's also structures that some mammals have that protect their mother as they're being born or during the pregnancy. And what I'm talking about is something that I've seen pictures of, and this is something that you should Google, is foal slippers is what they're called. That's one of the kind of more colloquial names for it. The scientific name is, I think I remember how to pronounce it, eponychium, I believe. And it's funny because it has the word pony in it, and this happens in horses. So I thought that was cute too. So in Latin, it means on top of little claw, but basically it's also called a hoof capsule. So essentially, when you think about hooved animals, so we're talking about the technical term is ungulates. Horses, cows, deer, and this is very cute, rhinos have them too. So they're called either foal slippers, they're called fairy fingers. You'll see why. It is the most alien looking thing that I've ever seen. So when horses are first born, they have it literally, it looks like a jellified, gooey, gelatinous alien hand on the tip of each of their hooves. And what that does is it prevents the horse from, you know, scratching up the mom's birth canal, you know, as they're being born. Otherwise, you know, the mom would be injured during birth. Right. And it's like a really interesting, like, scientific, like, evolutionary balance, right? Because these animals that have hooves, they have to walk like right away, like within minutes, maybe hours, very unlike us. So they have to have those fully formed hooves because they're on their own. You know, when they're out in the wild, they're born, you know, sorry, baby, you got to walk.
Yeah.
So they have to have the hoof. But if they have a fully developed hoof, they would for sure injure their mother, especially during, not only just during the birth, but during late pregnancy when babies, you know, fetuses are flipping all around and doing acrobatics in the womb.
Yeah, can you imagine like your kid like kicking you and it like being like, oh, the baby's kicking and now I'm bleeding internally.
It hurt plenty with no hooves, you know. I can't imagine if there's a hoof in there. But they don't have to worry about that because they have evolved to make these little gooey finger alien hands on the tips of their hooves.
Crazy.
Isn't that weird?
That is super weird. And then, like, so do the slippers, I guess they're called slippers. Do the slippers, like, dissolve? Or, like, how, like, what happens to them after they come out?
They immediately start drying up. So, like, within minutes to hours, they're already, like, drying up and kind of losing all their moisture and shriveling up. And then they just sort of wear off, you know, over the next couple days as the little horse or deer or whatever, you know, starts walking around, and it'll just sort of, like, slough off like over the next few days. So it's like a lot of water, so you know, it's just like this very gelatinous texture, and so like as soon as it hits the air, it immediately starts drying up and then it can just kind of flake off. But I did learn that you know, is it called the cuticle, the little, you know, skin that is at the base of your fingernail that sort of like overlaps like your nail a little bit, that it basically is a modified version of that. So like the skin at the base of where your nail grows is very similar to, you know, like our nail is very similar to the hoof of a cow or a horse.
Right.
So basically it's like almost the equivalent of that has evolved to be this protective jelly, fairy fingers, foal slippers, hand, little.
So weird.
Yeah. Thank goodness, because the poor mama horse would not.
Yeah, have no, she would be having a bad time. I mean, no, she's already having a bad time. I'm sure that she's already having a bad time. Like, birthing a four-legged animal.
It's not. I know. They have it easier than humans do. I don't know. They seem to have it more effortless, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I've never given birth to a horse, so.
I'm sure that I'm sure that they like face many of the same problems that humans do. Because do horses, do they come out feet first, or are they like humans where they come out head first?
I actually think they come out feet first.
I think only so because too.
I was very into, I forget which zoo, but one of the zoos that has the constant like camera feed of their giraffes. And, you know, I watched this pregnant giraffe for months. And then finally she went into labor and, you know, the whole world was like watching her birth. And I very vividly remember that the little giraffe feet came out first. And I think a horse and a giraffe have, you know, similar types of body structures with the hooves and the long face.
Google says, yes, horses usually come out of the birth canal with their front feet first.
Interesting.
Followed by their nose.
I guess that's just because their head isn't the biggest part, right? Because that's why humans have to be born head first, because the head's the biggest.
Yeah.
So they told me.
And I would think, too, that like if the legs were like folded in, that's more like circumference that has to go through the birth canal. Like it's easier for them to be like stretched out. So it sounds like the front legs come out, and then the head, and then the rest of the body like falls out.
Yeah. I mean, they really do fall. A lot of these animals like give birth standing up.
Yeah. I'm like, and if so any farmers are listening, maybe they can tell us in the comments if that's true.
Right. If you're a farmer or a horse, please dial into the show and tell us all about
if you're a horse experience. If you're a horse and you're listening, especially if you're a female horse that has gone through this. Be really helpful.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much it for my topic, you know, and the connection obviously between these is just, you know, nature has evolved these crazy fascinating structures to help animals be, you know, born / hatched safely so that everyone, you know, makes that out alive and uninjured. So
cool. That's so, weird.
So weird. So weird.
I had originally seen I just saw like a headline, I think on Facebook or something like that, about a very animal that sacrifices sleep for sex. And I was like, that's weird. Let me click on that. So the antechinus is a very tiny marsupial. They're typically roughly the size of a business card, like pretty small. Like they're like mice, kind of. Yeah, they're really little. They're located in three parts of Australia, and this was really sad. It said that 80% of their habitat was destroyed during the bushfires of 2019 to 2020.
No.
So that was pretty sad, but they're very, like, very little marsupials. They're like the size of mice, but they have a little pouch that they keep their young in, making them a marsupial.
And little tiny. So. I guess I didn't know that. They came that little. You always think of kangaroos and wallabies and it's so cute.
And they live communally in tree hollows, which I thought was really adorable.
That's a children's book waiting to happen.
I know, right? It's like, okay, but this part of
yeah, maybe not this thing part I'm for talk the about
is not it's not part of the stupid part. A good idea for a children's book. But yeah, they mostly eat bugs and they like live in trees, and they were only discovered in 2013, which I thought was really interesting, because that just seems like relatively recently.
Yeah,
within the last 10 years. Well, 11 years, I guess. But
yeah, discovering species. Well, I guess they discover new species all the time, but usually not new mammals. They discover new bugs and like little small tiny creatures all the time. But that's cool.
There's like a bunch of different kinds of antechinus, I guess. But I think they all share this trait of having semilparity, which is basically sexual suicide, basically meaning that they only have one sexual reproductive event and then they die. So in the case of the antechinus, what happens is the females are synchronously monoestrous, which essentially means that all of the females in one area all enter the mating cycle for a very short window of time. It's like 3 weeks, and they all enter the mating cycle at the same time and stay in the mating cycle for that same 3 weeks. And it only happens once a year. So it's just like this very short window of time that all the females are like, we're ready to make babies.
Let's go now.
Let's go. And I was looking up like what triggers that, the mating cycle for the females. They they do it by the length of daylight. And these females, I found an article that said that these females can sense as little as 97 seconds per day difference in sunlight.
Whoa.
Which I was like, it's like, I don't even know, like, if you asked me to, like, when 97 seconds from now was.
Yeah.
That just seems like a very short amount of time to, you know, be like, oh, this day the sun was up for 97 seconds more than yesterday.
Yeah, when you're talking about, oh yeah, like 12 hours and 97 seconds.
Yeah.
Versus, like, wow. Is it what? So, how do they sense like that time?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I know in birds, because birds are also really sensitive to like daylight cycles. That's how they also know what time of year it is and what time they're supposed to start making babies. In birds, it has something to do with the release of melatonin in their brains that makes them sleepy.
Okay.
Because birds see really poorly at night. So basically, as soon as the sun goes down, they just like go to sleep.
Right. Same.
Yeah. Same. So, but I know in birds, they have very sensitive melatonin secretion in their brains, so that like as soon as it gets dark, they're like, "Here's melatonin," and now you're asleep. So I don't know if I don't know if it's the same for these guys, but I'm willing to bet it's something like that. You know, where they have some kind of hormone or something that is released only at night, and that's how they can tell. So the females, like, they're the ones that kind of dictate when the mating season starts. And then the males, in response to that, they have this massive hormone release of testosterone and also cortisol. And the cortisol is the thing that basically ends up killing them, because cortisol is, as you might know, like, cortisol is like a stress hormone. It essentially suppresses your immune system. It suppresses like anything that's like non-essential to activity. So it puts a lot of glucose in your bloodstream so that your cells have energy and you can go and like run around and like do a lot of things. And it suppresses all these other functions in the body. So these males essentially then are like in this cortisol fueled sex rampage for weeks, and it takes like this horrible toll on their body. They start to go blind, and there's pictures online of these little antechinuses, and they have like tufts of hair that are missing because of this cortisol being in their bloodstream. They just like can't regulate any of like their immune system and growing fur, you know, skin and stuff,
anything
like that.
Not needed.
And yeah, exactly. So it also said that basically the cortisol rises really rapidly, and so does the testosterone, because the testosterone is what like makes them like fuck all these females. Yeah. So the testosterone surges, the cortisol surges, and then the testosterone actually suppresses the biological mechanism that allows the antechinus to metabolize cortisol. Because normally the antechinus, like, it would have this big surge of cortisol. Like, even if it was like running from a predator or something, it's going to release cortisol. But the cortisol is going to then get metabolized and not kill it.
Right.
So, okay. But the huge surge in testosterone somehow suppresses that metabolization mechanism. And then the cortisol just stays really high for weeks and weeks. And that's really bad for them.
They perish.
Because eventually the cortisol, it can lead to, because you have all this immune suppression, it can lead to organ failure and internal bleeding. And eventually, like, they just have organ failure and they just all die.
Oh, man.
So all the males every year, all the adult males just die. All of them. And it's very, very rare, it sounds like, that one of them survives, you know, this mating season and goes on to mate again, because they have such strong, like, hormone release that it essentially just poisons them. And at the end of the 3 weeks, like, they're so poisoned that they all just drop dead. And then hopefully they have gone and impregnated enough females to carry on the species, you know,
like,
hopefully the females will then birth new males that can carry, like, propagate the species.
Man.
Yeah. And essentially these little mouse sized marsupials, it said that they can fuck for 14 hours a day during this breeding period. And they just mate with as many females as they possibly can. And the article I read about the losing sleep, it said that they lose on average 3 hours of sleep per night, which didn't seem like a lot, because it sounds like when they're not in the mating season, they sleep for like 15 hours a day. Okay. So, you know,
we shouldn't give them too much credit.
Yeah. I was like, okay, so they're still like sleeping 12 hours. But I guess, you know, I mean, if you're used to sleeping 15 hours a day and then you're taking 3 of those hours and that's, you know, it's a lot of like physical activity that you're now adding to your day.
Yes.
Especially if you're trying to do it for 12 and more your hours.
Body regulation is all out of whack and you're in this crazy state where your cortisol levels are skyrocketing.
Yeah.
That's nuts. I guess my question is like, so as we learned with the tarantulas, they, you know, mature for several years in their burrow, and then tarantulas have a similar sort of, you know, explosive mating season, and then they die afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Do these mammals, do they only live like once a year and then like, you know, grow up for a year, die, and then the next cycle continues? Or do they like, does it take them a couple years to reach sexual maturity and then all those males? Or is it literally like,
I want to say that they reach sexual maturity pretty shortly after they're born.
Okay. I mean, that would make sense for a mouse-sized little mammal.
Yeah.
Like, that's very common for rodents, marsupials, I guess, rodents anyway. Tiny little mammals have very short lives in general.
Okay, so it says the male Antechinus reaches sexual maturity at 11 months.
Okay, so it literally is so like just a restart button every year.
He is born, he grows up, he reaches sexual maturity, he goes around and fucks a bunch of females, and then he dies.
Do you think we should still make this into a children's book?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it would be educational.
No, it's just the circle of life. All children need to learn about.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a thing that happens.
Oh, man.
Among the articles that I was reading, there was one that said that there were instances where, or like reports of people seeing male Antechinuses cannibalizing the other male Antechinuses that have already died because they just need so much energy to keep doing what they're doing. Right. And so they're just like, anything that is edible, they just eat it, which sometimes results in them eating their friends.
Well, you know, it's a good use of recycling the resources around you if they're dead already, you know.
I mean, they're not going to be using that, you know, and honestly, like, I mean, they're right about to die too, so, you know, you might as well just like do what you gotta do.
You know, everybody in the pool.
Yeah, exactly. The Antechinus for himself.
Yeah, man. And where did you say they live again?
Australia.
Australia. Oh, okay. So we have several Australian animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man, we got to go. I want to go see this one. Well, maybe I don't.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
It sounds kind of sad.
And yeah, I don't know. Fascinating and sad. Similar to when we saw those poor little tarantulas. It was so fascinating, but so sad knowing they were all going to die as soon as they found me.
Yeah. Because tarantulas, another species that participates in, or it has, you know, the characteristics of semelparity.
That's it. That's all you're good for.
And
your job is done.
Yep. No, not needed anymore. Bye. And I guess there's a couple of other like small marsupials that have a similar like semelparity.
I'm sure there's a lot of animals that like, it's just like an evolutionary tool for communal animals, especially that like depends so much on like seasonality, that like, hey, if this only can happen during this season, this month, this sounds like in this case, the week or day, even if you're talking about less than a minute or a minute and a half of daylight difference, you know, that could be the difference of just a day or two.
Yeah.
You know, if you need it to happen right then, it's like, you got to save up all your resources. You got to go. So I think any creature that has like that degree of like seasonality. Can you imagine if like humans could only reproduce during like 1 month of the year? Like how different our community would be.
Yeah, how different like, our society would be, and just yeah. civilization in general. You know,
antikinases.
Yeah.
Wait, did I say it right?
Yeah.
Antikinase.
Yeah. Okay. Antikinase.
Antikinase. Okay.
Antikodesis. What a
strange not roll off your tongue name.
I know.
You should come up with a different name.
I know, right?
Who do we speak to?
Yeah, I'm like,
we use someone's name.
Yeah, like responsible for the names of the animals.
Is it like a Latin? Is that the Latin name, or and it just never got like a common name, or is that the common name?
I don't know if that's the Latin
name. If it doesn't have a common name, can we make one?
Yeah, can we just call it like the sex rage mouse? Yeah,
something. It's pretty accurate. You know, yeah, we need an accurate name.
The sex suicide mouse.
Yep. Yep.
And then we can write a children's book about it.
About that and the tarantulas.
Mm-hmm.
And the fall slippers. You know, all the creepy things belong in a children's book.
Oh, okay. So I guess Antikinus is like the Latin name. It's Antikinus Stuarti.
Okay. Huh. So maybe it just isn't popular enough to have a common name.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to work on that.
Yeah,
who do we got to call?
Because there are different ones. There's like a brown Antikinus. There's the dusky Antikinus. Yellow-footed Antikinus.
Yellow-footed. You know, I wonder what would happen if they were kept in captivity. Because sounds like, you know, like with the same conditions, and let's say they were kept in a enclosure that had the same lighting every single day, 365 days a year, would they still die that way? You know, like if it wasn't triggered by, like, it sounds like it's a very specific sequence of events that happens where the, you know, the daylight happens, or the, you know, the timing of the daylight happens, the female gets her hormones triggered, then all the males get their hormones, and it's a chain reaction.
Yeah.
But if that didn't become initiated from nature's cycle, yeah, like, would they be able to live?
Or like, what if you initiated it in captivity, and yeah, then you artificially uninitiated it, you know?
Yeah.
Like made the day like way longer so that they like 2 days later they thought it was summer. And
yeah.
And that,
I wonder
like,
how that would
stop the process.
A cruel experiment, but fascinating. Yeah, okay, cool. Anything else to add about our sex crazed
No, I think that was it. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today on Weird, the podcast.
You can contact us on Instagram at weird.podcast.
You can subscribe to us on YouTube at Weird, the podcast.
Or shoot us an email at thepodcastweird@gmail.com.
Thanks, everyone. It's been weird.
Okay, hang on. I'm going to look up the pronunciation because I want to say it's Antikinus. If I keep calling them Antikinuses this whole episode and if that's not how you pronounce it, it's going to be embarrassing.
Antikinus.
Antikinus.
Antikinus. Okay, that's how I'm saying it. Antikinus.
All right, my human child is coughing here in the background.
So it's like...
Yeah, it's kind of backlit.
Yeah.
It's the eclipse.
Have a little bit of like... Yeah.